This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.
Coaxial.
Hello there, it's Coaxial. I'm Christian Corley and this is Gareth Cavana.
Hello. It's been an age.
It has been an age. We did convene a few weeks ago, didn't we, for a short coaxial. I don't know about you. I'm if you notice my voice changing throughout this podcast, it's because I've got a cold.
I hadn't noticed.
It's only started this morning.
Oh, how annoying.
Yeah, and it's just sitting there at the back of my throat. We once did a podcast for Coaxial, didn't we, on the topic of teletext.
Oh, the fabled teletext, lost one.
The lost podcast, yes.
That was a good one, that. That was me. I was on a high because I'd been to that Kaleidoscope event in Birmingham where we'd seen live teletext recovery from a videotape from 1976.
Yeah.
It was exciting. It was like the Dead Sea Scrolls coming back, but the Dead Sea Scrolls told us who was number one in 1976. Yeah, no, it was a good one, that. And a technical malfunction meant we lost it. So it was a missing, believe, wiped. In fact, missing, never recorded in the first place.
The computer said it was recording it, so presumably it was recorded somewhere. It just got lost. It used to be that you'd be able to find temporary files like that, but that didn't happen that day. I wasn't able to find it, which was a major blow. The reason that I'm minded to call back to that lost podcast is a tweet that I saw.
Oh, yeah, this is Lord Buckethead, isn't it?
The amazingly named Lord Buckethead.
I love Lord Buckethead. He's great.
Who says, exciting news, Bucket fans. I'm on a fact-finding mission in Italy and I've discovered that they have CFAX.
Nice.
And finishes, I shall return it to Britain. I'm not sure how practical that would be. I seem to recall when I was in Greece about 17 years ago that they also had a text service. And I'm less inclined to believe... Or rather, I'm inclined to believe that they would probably still have it, what with having lots of, you know, separate islands and what have you.
I suppose it depends on whether you've still... If you're still broadcasting in the traditional sort of, you know, analogue way, then you'll still have teletext because the digital services won't be different. If, like us, you've short-sightedly turned off all of the classic transmitters and just gone digital only, then CFAX has died. It would not surprise me. I mean, who knows, you know, CFAX could still be huge in Albania,
like Benny Hill,
well, you know, and Norman Wisdom, isn't it?
Yes, Norman Wisdom, that's it. Yes, Norman Wisdom.
Although I bet they like Benny Hill as well.
I bet they do as well.
Yeah, but people of taste, those hard-working Albanians, they know quality when they see it.
There was also something else, just casting our minds back to that teletext discussion. I discovered that you can do... Actually, this is something I need to look into and have see how they've got on with it now. The little Raspberry Pi computer is capable of running teletext.
Oh, I would have thought so, yeah.
Yeah, it is, yeah. There was a project around at the time when we did that podcast, which I was going to follow up with. It also reminded me, I had a teletext program on my Commodore 64. Obviously, you couldn't broadcast it, but you could, which I believe you can with the Raspberry Pi, or at least send it across a web or a closed network. But on the Commodore 64, you could make teletext pages. I imagine you probably could on a BBC Micro as well, as I suspect that's where teletext originated.
Oh, I bet they were running it off BBC Micro.
Yeah,
absolutely convinced. I also remember reading about, we never got it, that there was a way in the 80s that you could download computers, you could download programs from teletext with a little device that would link to your BBC Micro.
Really?
Yeah, we never got one in our school, sadly. But I remember thinking how exciting this is. You know, bearing in mind, I knew one person with a modem back then, and it was one of them big ones that you had to put, you know, like off War Games, that you had to put a handset on, into the thing, you know, into the big receiver, and then it would speak computerish to it. You know, teletext was the, you know, you know, the idea that I could download high quality programs and probably educational stuff about the Black Death off Teletext was very exciting.
Black Death. what else? So your school had BBC Micro. How many did you have? Do you remember?
Gosh, let's see. Primary school didn't have any computers at all. Secondary school had, I tell you what it had. We had two BBC Micro A's, the 16K ones, which were useless, and two BBC B's with 32K with disk drive.
Yeah.
Which meant you could go in at lunchtime for computer club, which actually meant playing games. And I don't know if you used to do this, but discs were quite expensive. And I had a disc, and someone worked out if you Stanley knifed a little notch on the other side, you could turn the disc over and make it double-sided.
Yeah.
But you had to watch that you didn't cut a bit of the disc
cut
out.
Cut into the disc, yeah.
You know,
I did do that.
CCT, you know, it was... You know, it was a bit like The Great Escape. You'd pretend to be making this high-quality mustard spoon, but really you were Stanley knifing, precision Stanley knifing 5 1/4 discs. Oh, happy days.
My school, because I'm a couple of years younger than you as well, so maybe it's something to do with some sort of national rollout. My primary school had, I think, two BBCs. And the thing that I always remember about them is that the load, not just the load time for the programs, which was invariably games in inverted commas to teach you fire safety or something like that.
Yes, and things about the Black Death.
Oh, things about the Black Death. Yeah, there were those. So that racket that the tape would make as it was loading. Now I'm pretty sure that they didn't have to have it on that loud, because my aunt and uncle had a BBC. My uncle was I'm not entirely sure what he was, but he was some sort of teacher anyway.
Right.
And so they had a BBC, and whenever we went to their house and they put the computer on, it never made that noise. So I'm pretty sure that the teachers had it screeching like that for either for shits and giggles or to tell when the software had loaded.
Oh, they didn't know what they were doing.
All that, yeah. Well, it was the future then, wasn't it? It was like...
As you get older, you realise that's what was most of the time was going on with teachers. They didn't quite know what they were doing, but just hid behind this stern wall of authority, which meant you can't question that, you know, because they knew that if you worked out they didn't quite know what they were doing most of the time, the whole edifice would crumble.
Well, there's the whole morality side of teachers as well, isn't there? There's this sort of... I had a friend many years ago who had a big thing about teachers not being these kind of moral gatekeepers that they claim to be.
Mm.
And, he was absolutely right, because they're just human. And that's it. I mean, it opened my eyes, I can tell you.
Well, we had a very strange mix of teachers. Now I think back, we had Mr. Lloyd, who taught physics, and he structured every double physics lesson so he could have 3 fag breaks, you know. So he'd either put a video on, or he'd put an overhead projector slide up with lots of technical things that you had to copy down, and then he'd go off and have a fag, and he'd come back reeking of fags. I remember one very strange lesson where he explained to us about orgasms and women's orgasms. It's very odd.
Oh, that's getting into Python territory, isn't it?
It is.
Meaning
it was
of
like
life.
He was passing his global knowledge on. it was very odd.
Do you know, I'm so affected by that scene in that film that when we came to doing sex education in second
Brilliant, isn't it?
I wrote sex Need education practical.
Yeah.
In my exercise book.
That one is it. Do you know, it's so underrated, the meaning of life.
It is.
It's like the Python film no one talks about, and I think it's the best one of all.
The only thing I can't handle is the thing in the corridor with Terry Jones and Graham Chapman.
I can't even remember that.
Terry Jones has the long hands, that has like the extended hands, and Graham Chapman's in the worst drag outfit ever.
Wow.
Just as some sort of bird. See, you can't remember it. That's because it's the worst part of the film, and people
I just can't remember it.
Skip it.
I really literally can't remember it. You know, God, I've just obviously erased that, but, you know, from the Crimson Permanent Assurance Company...
Everything else is brilliant, yeah.
To
yeah,
the Salmon yeah. Mousse, it's just wall-to-wall gold.
Well, Christmas in Heaven.
Christmas in Heaven's great as well.
Yeah.
So it's the Doctor Who Christmas episode we never got. yeah, that one is good. Yeah. I tell you what I've just remembered. Bizarrely, we also had two Oric computers in our computer room.
What, from Blake 7?
No, not Oric. That would be much handier. You know, that would be much handier. Oric, please explain in 100 words how you derive ozone from H2O.
Oric, what was the Black Death? These
sniffling questions. Yeah, that would have been good.
No, well, you say that. We had a Marvin at our school. No, go on. Anyway, you had some Oric.
A Marvin? What the hell's a Marvin?
Paranoid Android.
Ah. That would have been even better.
It would. But you had Oric.
We had
I've never
Oric.
Even seen an
they
Oric in real evidence.
You know,
were they the ones with flat keyboards?
They were basically like snided spectrums.
Right.
And the only thing I can remember about the Oric, because, you know, if you got there late, all that was left was the Oric. And it was a bloody awful thing. And, but the Oric had all these pre-programmed sounds. So if you typed in like something like, I don't know, sound zap, it would go zap. If you did sound bang, it would make a bang noise. Right. That was it. You know, once you'd been through this feeble collection of about 15 preloaded sounds, that was Oric fun time over. That was it.
It sounds a wheeze. I'm just looking up the Oric because I think I do vaguely. I've never seen one in real life. I don't think, but it. I'm. All those old. Oh, those are weird keys. They're like buttons, aren't they?
Yeah.
Oh, they're horrendous. I think I was thinking of a dragon. When I said flat
well,
keys.
They were.
But yeah, one of the things I kind of regret doing this. I used to have loads of old computer magazines from the early. Mid 80s, and I've binned them all, and the adverts in them were fantastic.
Oh, they were. I used to fall for it every time. There'd always be a classified ad where someone was selling, you know, I don't know, street, you know, the Knight Rider game or Rambo or something, a quid cheaper, and it was listed as available now or available October. So you'd send your postal order off for $6.95 and you'd wait months.
Yeah.
Months and months and months. It was such a scam, you know, because everyone else would say available November. One would go, available October. And you'd go, ooh, they've got it quicker. Right. Here's my postal order for £6.95. Please send it to Master Gareth Cavanagh, you know. And yeah, never arrived.
Oh.
Never, ever arrived. Terrible.
Bastards.
But yes, those adverts were great.
Yeah. They're and because you might see a few of them on the internet now, but they're usually Apple ones. But there's that the whole general sort of look of people in the 80s and the way adverts were composed and all that sort of thing. It's a coaxial all of its own, actually.
Oh, it is.
We can do that as well because there's a coaxial cable on the back of old computers.
There was a real scam going on. There were computer shops who set themselves up as being educational tools. And these are the kind of buggers who sucked in my old man. So Christmas Day 1983, me wanting a Spectrum, what do I get? A Dragon 32.
Oh, no.
With chess cartridge. And I'm like, what's that? Oh, it's very good educational. You can program it. And it's like, nobody programs. You know, so yeah, you type out that, you know, you spend the whole... I did learn how to type, actually. I did learn how to type, typing these things out. But
from
that's
magazines.
The only good thing I got out of it. You know, it was terrible. And then there were the other computer shops. I don't even remember them. They were like the slaggy computer shops. They were just, no, we might have a keyboard somewhere. We might have an educational how-to-code book somewhere that we've blown the dust off. No, this is all about games.
Yeah.
Fill your boots, guys. Games, games, games. Because that's what we wanted, really.
It's funny you mention that, because yesterday, just yesterday, Kerry and I were walking through the wind-whistling streets of Redcar.
Aye.
And we passed the location. It's not anymore. It's some sort of tattoo house or something now. But 30 years ago, it was a computer shop.
Oh, yeah.
And it was where I bought a good chunk of my early Commodore 64 games.
Oh, so thrilling.
And you'd go in there, and there would be desks around the place. It was like a cyber cafe in some, visually. Yeah. Computers all over the place. You could go up and try out, play the joystick, play the keyboard. They would sell Commodore 64s and Spectrums and Amigas and Ataris as they came out later in the Atari 520 ST. And they'd have all the games there. But they'd also be doing the business stuff as well. And it was a fantastic shop. But for some reason, over the years, I think there was a bit of a collapse in the computer market in the 80s, wasn't there? And it went from being a three unit shop down to a 2 unit shop, down to a 1 unit shop, and then it closed and got replaced with or bought out by another computer shop. But it was a great place to go and just look at what was available.
Oh, it's marvel! Just marvel. You know, I had a paper round. It meant I had spending power to more or less buy a new game every week.
Yeah.
And gave you, in the Spectrum market, that gave you currency to trade, you know, because then you'd nip round your mate's house, you'd swap him a copy of that for a copy of his. Oh, it was a golden era.
Was making copies easy on Spectrum?
Oh, Spectrum was ever so easy. Any old tape-to-tape thing would do. You just didn't even have to really mess around with the levels. Now, Commodore was virtually impossible to copy.
Yeah, you had to have a cartridge.
Yeah, they really nailed it down. That was annoying. But Spectrum, fill your boots. A C90, that was good for about 20 games.
Wow. I've still got my Action Replay cartridge for my Commodore 64. Well, I've still got my Commodore 64 and all the games as well, actually. But I don't know if the cartridge still works. I don't even know if the Commodore 64 still works, to be honest.
Best it fires up. And with them big C90 tapes, I got to the point where you could hold down, you'd play, and then hold down fast forward, and it'd zoom forward, and you'd just... Your ear was trained to you, knew where the gap was, and that was where the new game was. And it was, kids of today, they won't realise how crazed it was, but how exciting. And mildly disappointing when the game didn't quite live up to the exciting graphics. But that was always part of the deal in a strange way.
Yeah. Well, it was that beautiful ornate box art, wasn't it?
Oh, works of art.
That sold most of the games, and like you say, they're rarely... matched what was promised on the cover, but some games did, and even if they didn't look as good, there was still the massive playability. So
it was
a bit of a lottery, but you know, there's only one way to find out, wasn't
there? Oh, there was I liked, there was something about that era. There was it was a great British success story, actually, the game software industry back then. You know, it was an explosion of content and software and talent, which I suppose went on to build an industry which lasted a fair while. It's probably, I don't think the British games sector is quite what it was, but certainly 20, 30 years ago, I think we were probably the best in the world.
I think we probably were. I think Germany had a good good choice of games as well. They had very, obviously being German, it was very inward looking. But there's a lot of good games came out of Germany, and a few of them got adapted or... German developers like Manfred Trentz, who did Turrican and a few other games.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was a good one. Great Anarchist is one that jumps out. Which
was
that was
one of his as well, I think.
2 weeks before Nintendo went,
I
think you find this is a bit close to Mario. It's
that's either the same developer or the same development team as Turrican, if I remember
right.
The thing about that era, though, was I mean, you're absolutely right about the games. A lot of people forget about what happened with the hardware. And it takes us back to the BBC as well. Because BBC later when we had the Archimedes.
Oh, yeah, that was a good game. The problem was, I had a pal who had an Archimedes. He was like, you know, they were a BBC family through and through. You know, they started off on the cheapy Electron. Then they went up to the BBC. Then they had the Archimedes. You know, they probably now have got Apples. But my God, the games were boring. He'd come around and say, you know, you've got to see the new specs on the hardware. And you'd go, okay, let's see the games. And they'd go, well, there's not that many, but they're brilliant. They're very good. And the Archimedes just wasn't, I don't know whether they either didn't encourage it as a games machine.
I don't think they did, really.
No, they wanted it for serious stuff.
Yeah, it was for serious stuff. I did my GCSE art exam. I did half of my work on a computer.
Nice.
Yeah. And I little brag, I did get an A, so I did quite a good job with it. But I was then chased away from the world of art by angry as well as mad, art tutor at college. So I put pay to my artistic.
You know, I loved art, but I was too busy with all the other subjects, so I never completed all my folio pieces.
Oh,
so
dear, that's a shame.
You know,
well, the thing about the Archimedes as well, and I don't want to make this too IT-ish, but it was made by Acorn in Cambridge.
Yes.
And it was based on the ARM architecture, which is basically your architecture is basically your processor and your motherboard.
It's very basic.
Now that ARM still exists. ARM's in all of our phones.
That's right. The Japanese bought it out only recently, didn't they?
Yeah, quite recently. Yeah. So ARM, you know, the hardware element. There's an ARM processor in the Raspberry Pi, which we mentioned earlier. ARM processors are everywhere. So, they're probably the biggest success story in British computing.
I guess they are, really. The problem with the Spectrum is that Sir Clive, the Spectrum should have been the one that kept evolving, growing, except he bugged it up with the QL and the C5 and then ran out of cash. A similar thing happened to Electron, but you're right, because they had that ARM processor, the spirit of Electron has just kept going and going.
No, I wasn't aware of the Sinclair QL.
Oh, it's terrible. There's a brilliant film. I know a bit about this because I produced a play called Together in Electric Dreams, which was Sinclair at dinner with Alan Sugar.
Alan Sugar, yeah.
In 1986, where we researched and we interviewed people, but basically Sinclair was 48 hours from the bank foreclosing on him. Because he'd run out of cash and he was trying to sell Spectrum and he wanted to sell everything. He wanted to sell, the development arm, all his prototypes, all his other products. And Sugar just wanted the Spectrum. He wanted the proven technology that he could flog to Dixon's for another 5 years, arguably, which is what he did.
Yeah.
And they cut a deal over dinner. But there's another one. Do you remember that film, which is called Microben, which is a BBC 4 one, which was about the founder of Acorn at war with Clive Sinclair? It's
on the
Google. It's brilliant. It's from 2009.
Right.
And these guys absolutely hated each other because Clive Sinclair and Chris Curry originally worked together. And then Curry went off his own way, set up Acorn, and won the contract with the BBC to do an educational machine that they would support with the program and then roll out. It's a wonderful, wonderful film. It is on the U of Tube, and I would thoroughly recommend losing an hour and a half.
Oh, well, we'll stick that in the show notes.
Alexander Armstrong is Sinclair. He's brilliant. And Martin Freeman is Chris Curry. So it's got a really, really good cast, but there's a moment where Clive Sinclair launches the QL because he wants a serious machine for serious business users, and there's a bit where he goes, are we allowed to swear? You can always beep it out.
Go on, then.
There's a bit where he's in a corridor with his aides, and with one of his aides, and he says, oh well, the games are selling well. And he goes, this is my life's work. Reduced to the Sir Clive Sinclair, the inventor of Jet Set fucking Willy. And I think that was the problem. Sir Clive saw himself as a serious, a serious computer man, a serious inventor, a serious business, something for, he wanted to be Apple, basically, and he ended up being Nintendo. Mm. And instead of embracing it and going, actually, there's a lot of money in being Nintendo, so let's make sure we put joystick ports on the Spectrum and all sorts of other things. It's like, no, you will be digitizing your bank records, you will be crafting spreadsheets on my QL, that's what we want. So that's why Sugar wins, really, because he works out what people want and flogs it to them as cheap as he can.
Yeah. He doesn't always get it right, of course.
No. Although he apparently he says the emailer was in the end a success. It just took 11 years to get the money back. He did make some terrible products, Sugar. He made a good one, though. I remember really... Do you remember his double-decker video recorder?
No.
Yeah. He came up with a double-decker video recorder in the mid-90s that would let you record two things at once on videotape. Stunning-looking. It looks like a toaster, you know, an end-on toaster. But I know, I liked it. I would have had one. Definitely would have had one. I still want one, even though I don't record anything.
I should maybe look some of these up. I used to have an Amstrad PCW.
The old green screen word processor, which, yeah, so he suckered everyone in to buy that for people's homework, yeah.
With 3-inch discs, so you buggers, if you've still got the discs, you're never going to be able to read them again unless you can get hold of a 3-inch.
Do you know, there's so much work locked up on those discs from the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
Because quite often I'll speak to, you know, Doctor Who comic writers and Doctor Who writers from that era. And there's drafts, there's notes, there's all sorts of stuff. And they're just sat in boxes and attics, all being chucked out.
I've got stuff like that. Can't see it again.
No, because how would you? I suppose you'd have to boot it up and boot up the daisy wheel printer and physically print it off so no one bothers.
Exactly. I had a few months ago, I had a device for review called... Oh, Christ, what was it called? I forgot what it was called. It's basically, it might be an Amoebian or something like that. It's basically a Commodore Amiga powered by, it wasn't even a Raspberry Pi. It was a Commodore Amiga emulator. Mm. But it came with the floppy drive as well. So I was able to find some old artwork I'd done on my Amiga and some old stuff that I'd written. I managed to save the artwork and the stuff that I'd written. And then a few days, well, not long after, the hard drive on my laptop decided to go a bit crackers, and I lost the stuff that I'd written again. And I'd sent this computer away to its winner.
Oh.
So I wasn't able to retrieve the text anymore. It was a bit of a bugger.
So you could play the Amiga discs on it.
You couldn't play them. What you could do is create an image of them.
Oh, I see.
And then run them on the thing. I'm just going to find out what it was called. Flaming forgotten, and I shouldn't have forgotten because it was a great little thing.
Well,
I really
wanted. You know, the irony is, had Doctor Who been on air in the 90s, I think we'd have lost loads of stuff. Lots of stuff would be missing. You'd literally be going, oh my god, it's Andrew Cartmell's old PCW from 1992. Think of the treasures.
Yeah. Here we go. It was called an Amiga. Basically, looks like a long old style disk drive. The thing is, you can't, with, if you had a 3.5-inch PC disk drive, if you had, an old-style Tel PC and you had a disk drive for that, you wouldn't have been able to put an Amiga disk in that because it read in a different way.
Ah, I see.
So you had to have a very specific disk drive working in a particular way or program to work in a particular way.
Yeah.
Bit of a pain, all told. But
they chugged away, didn't they? I remember the Atari ST disk drive really chugged.
Yeah, they did. I had an Amiga, as you may have gathered by now, and you know, if you didn't have a hard drive in it, and that was like £100 for like a 10 megabyte hard drive,
yeah,
something ridiculous like that. If you didn't have a hard drive, towards the end of the Amiga's time, you'd be playing games that were on like 12 discs.
Yeah, I remember.
And there'd be loads of discs. Yeah, it'd be a real.
I remember the Indiana Jones games sort of being spread over about 5 discs.
Yeah,
and,
Last Crusade and that. Yeah, yeah.
All those sort of games. God, yeah, it was a real multi-load, wasn't it? It was a bit of a false dawn, the Atari ST, now I look back. It did certain things very well, but it was very quickly superseded. And it seemed to look old a lot quicker than things like the Commodore and Spectrum did.
Yeah, that is weird.
Yeah, it is weird. I suppose Atari never really backed the software. And I suppose, both Atari and Commodore were in financial trouble by then, so they weren't able to invest in the R&D.
Well, I think Atari... They basically saw the ST as a, you know, part of the band, didn't they? They saw it as a studio instrument.
Yeah, but they were hedging their bets, weren't they? You know, it was great for games, but it couldn't scroll sideways easily. Yeah, you're right. It was really just there for that MIDI port. But, I mean, I seem to remember reading that Mark Ayres had, you know, did all the music for his McCoy stuff on his ST.
Right.
But it could only save something like 15 minutes of music at a time. No, 15
really?
Seconds of music at a time.
Good
and
Lord.
Then you had to stitch it all together.
Good Lord.
Which doesn't seem quite worth the effort.
Doesn't seem practical, does it? No. I suppose it depends on the results, though. Although the interesting thing about the Atari, we're heading into a real nerdy Stan territory here, but I will persist with this line.
Oh, don't worry. Our four listeners will appreciate it.
The thing about the Atari ST is that I believe it had the same sound chip as the Commodore 64. But because it had 512 kilobytes of memory, you could do a lot more with it.
Well, that's true. But do you know, that Commodore sound chip, the SID chip, my God, they could do some incredible music. I mean, I've got some Commodore CDs, and that music is stunning. You know, because it's what, four tracks or eight tracks? It's something for the time. It's
something
really
like that, yeah.
Fabulous. And it's all Jean-Michel Jarre and synthy and, you know, you know, such music, such sounds.
Well, I've got an
Rambo
album of...
Loader is my favourite.
I've got an album of remastered music from Commodore 64 by Chris Hulsbeck, who, going back to a game mentioned earlier, Turrican, he did the soundtrack for Turrican. And that's basically what the album is. It's the remastered version of the Turrican music. It's absolutely superb. Yeah. I have it on in the car. It's fantastic.
There's an amazing guy in Belgium who does like these live performances of Commodore stuff and mixes. His mix of Whizball is fantastic. God, I haven't listened to that for years. They was, you know, they really knew how to make those machines tick and sing and hum. You know, games like Paradroid, not much to look at, but my God, well designed.
Yeah.
So playable, so clever. Do you know what? I dug out Defender of the Crown the other week.
All right.
Yeah, I found it on my Game Boy Advance in a box of stuff, and it's a brilliant. It's a faithful adaptation of the 1986 original. And, it was thrilling. I spent 2 hours rampaging through medieval England as Cedric of Rotherwood, crushing my neighbours brutally, you know.
I figured out
the trick is to call Robin early in the day. You know, you call him on the first couple of castles you smite because you need his 50 men then, and then you're all right. You leave it too late. You know, if you save up your Robins, you've had it. Reginald Fontbeuf spreads like a sort of, you know, like a sort of a red horde across your lands, and before you know it, all you're left with is Northumberland and four gold pieces.
Well, do you know, when we started this podcast, I had no idea we were going to be doing strategy advice for an 8-bit game.
Indeed. Oh, 16, you know.
Oh, it's 16, big fan, yeah.
16, I know. But, you know, but teletext... All these games and teletext, bringing back to teletext, they're an expression of an optimistic vision of the future where technology will be a friendly thing in our homes. It'll help to solve our problems. You know, it's going to be there and part of our lives. And teletext and the Commodores and the Spectrums, they're the very first expression of that. Before that, computers were just like great big wardrobes with spinning wheels that you used to see on the $6 million man. No one really saw a computer, but we did. We were the first people who did, really, and they've been part of our lives ever since.
You're absolutely right. You know, about 15 or so, a bit more than that, years ago, I worked at Chorus, which was the then name of British Steel.
Oh, the Steel, yeah.
And I was only there for about 3 or 4 months. And what I discovered was, although they didn't have a mainframe anymore, they still called it the mainframe.
Nice. Nice.
They were talking about the mainframe. I was like, what were you talking about, mainframe? What are you talking about? It was very amusing. Very amusing.
God, yeah, it's one of those words that no one uses anymore. That's true.
Yeah.
You know, anyone under the age of 30 probably wouldn't have even come across that word.
Certainly not now, no.
No.
Certainly not now. It's that whole era, and it's not just the home side of it as well. It's, you know, the flip side of that was like the educational institutions with their mainframes and their, you know, their access to the infant's internet and all that sort of thing going on.
Oh, yes, that early sharing of knowledge. Wow.
So, yeah, it's a fascinating era of, as you say, the late 70s to mid-80s, really, I suppose.
It's a time of hope and optimism and a feeling that, you know, that these things are going to solve. And, in fact, you know, there's an argument that the West's superiority in computing and embrace of computing power is actually what won the Cold War.
I thought you were going to say the World Cup, then.
The World Cup, oh, yeah. Well,
what won the Cold War? You could well be, yeah.
You know. Well, I'm sure it probably helped as well. But it because this was, it's all to do with Reagan's Star Wars program. And the reason that as I've read it, the Soviets backed down in the end on it and they couldn't match it, is that they worked out that, yes, they could probably come up, they could probably build the lasers. They could probably build the ballistic missiles to intercept the ICBMs, but they didn't have the computing power to sequence and target, because they hadn't really developed their computing side of their game. Whereas so it was Silicon Valley and all those advances in computing that actually made them think, oh my God, yes, they can build the lasers, they can build the missiles, and yes, they can probably target them with their super duper 1 megabyte computer mainframes. So it even wins for us. You know, it delivers us from the Cold War. I like to think it's that simple.
I always like to think it was the Beatles that won it for us, but
All you need is love.
I didn't necessarily mean that, but you know, just the general, just rock and roll, really. But yeah.
Well, I think that's probably true in East Germany, in Eastern Europe.
Mm.
You know, they desired the mullets and the
and the
Hasselhoff stylings.
Yeah, well, you could they just broadcast it, didn't they? And they could pick it up.
Oh yeah.
And they weren't getting any of it in real life. So I've gone wildly off track here, but. One of the best things I like about classic TV show The Professionals is in the final two series, there's loads of East Germans and Poles and Hungarians.
Oh, yeah.
Spy outfits running in London.
Well, I think they were very good at it.
Oh, yeah, they were.
I think the East German Stasi was one of the best outfits for subjugating their own people and spying on everything going in the world. They were world leaders in that.
You know, until Facebook came along.
But their spying was, you know, in that top quartile.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot of that goes on in the old professional, the later Professionals episodes. Do you know what? We should probably wrap this up.
I know. We're really... we've covered some ground, haven't we?
Well, haven't we just? I'm just going to finish off and recommend a show that I'm watching on Amazon Prime, it's not like a series, it's just a one-off that I found, which I think I bought. It's called Viva Amiga, which nice. plunges you straight into that early 80s to mid-90s Commodore Amiga.
That's the East Germans.
Commodore Amiga. It's described as a retro love letter to the freaks, geeks, and geniuses behind the best damn computer ever made, the Commodore Amiga. It wasn't expensive. I bought it with some Amazon credit that I had. It's worth checking out.
Lovely. And I can thoroughly recommend Micro Men. It's out there, and it's wonderful.
Excellent. Well, that's us wrapping up a coaxial. Enjoy it, and we'll see you again soon. Bye-bye.
Right.